You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Thank you for joining us on the Hayek Program Podcast. This is the Women in Policy series. My name is Jessica Cargis, and our guest today is Carol Boudreau. Carol has a JD in International Law from the University of Virginia, and her work over the past two decades has focused on efforts to support improvements to land tenure and property rights for people around the world with a strong focus on sub-Saharan Africa. This includes her time spent at the Mercatus Center, where she was the lead researcher for the Enterprise Africa Project. She focuses on understanding links between property rights systems and development, as well as the evolution of property systems. Today, we will be discussing women's land and resource rights in sub-Saharan Africa. Carol, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Jessica. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we take it for granted in the United States that women generally have the same economic rights as men. We can open bank accounts and lines of credit. We can own property. We can hold our own jobs, earn a salary, and then spend that salary as we'd like. But this is not necessarily the case worldwide. Your work specifically focused on sub-Saharan Africa might tell a different story or a different narrative. Could you just provide us with a little bit of context? What does women's economic rights look like in sub-Saharan Africa? What's the variation between countries? Are there any general trends that you'd like to point out?
Sure. So what I can say maybe to start is that you're right. There are real differences between the way women are able to hold, benefit from, control, manage, make decisions about land, resources, whether those are financial resources or more like natural resources across sub-Saharan Africa. Might be interesting for some of your viewers to know that the part of the world, the region of the world that has the lowest level of women's land ownership, documented land ownership, is actually the Middle East. So the North Africa into the Middle East region, there are estimates suggest that about maybe about 5% of land is actually owned or formally owned or recognized as owned by women. Situation is actually a little bit better in sub-Saharan Africa, so outside of the MENA region. One problem is very few countries in sub-Saharan Africa actually have complete, up-to-date, dependable, formal land registries or information systems. And so we take our best guess at what's the percentage of women who formally, that is, with a certificate or a title, own land in sub-Saharan Africa. That number would be about 20%. In some countries, it might be a bit higher. In Rwanda, for example, very unusual case, the government has surveyed, mapped, titled every parcel of land in the country. And so women's joint ownership of land with husbands or with other family members would be higher in Rwanda than in almost any other country, with the exception perhaps of South Africa. One other thing to say that I think most Americans aren't aware of is that in many African countries, all land is formally owned or vested in the hands of the federal or national level government. So, for example, ownership of all land in Tanzania vests in the president of Tanzania. So when we talk about what women and men both are able to do with regard to land in sub-Saharan Africa, it's usually have a use right which over that land, not have the sort of fee simple freehold ownership experience or opportunity that we would have here in the United States. So women own a small amount of land. Many of them are living under, also many of them are living outside of formal legal systems. They're living under customary systems that are managed by traditional authorities, chiefs, other actors, where maybe nobody has any documented rights to land. That was a lot. Let me pause.
No, that was a lot, but it was really interesting. Do you have an idea of just how many countries, or is it a majority, or like what percentage of countries is it where the leader of that country has the land right ownership, and then he or she grants use to their citizens? Is that typical, or is that like an exception?
It's very typical. So most countries in sub-Saharan Africa will vest ownership of land, water, trees and forests, and for sure subsurface mineral wealth in the hands of, you know, it's usually the president of the country. So there is, if you want to think about it like in this way, there's a real concentration of, in some senses, ownership of land and natural resources in much of sub-Saharan Africa. It is the case, though, as I mentioned just a minute ago, in a lot of countries, they're side-by-side pluralistic legal systems. So there's a formal statutory system that will say ownership of land, like in Tanzania, vests in the office of the president. If you want to transfer your long-term use right, or you want to gain a long-term use right, you actually have to go all the way up through the president's office in many cases to get a transfer or some adjustment approved to what you do. But in addition, I think it's really important to understand that these national level governments are also controlling other resources. This may not be the case anymore, but until a few years ago, it was estimated that 99% of all forests in Africa were controlled, owned by the governments.
Oh, wow. 99%. Interesting. This is like a nationalized, not just land ownership, but also many natural resources, forests, water, I'm assuming as well, is similar.
Yeah. So it constrains what you can do economically with the resources. If you're just an average person or a woman farmer out in the countryside, what you can do is probably going to be defined by your traditional leader. If you're living in a society where there are still traditional leaders, another example in Zambia, 90% of the land is controlled by chiefs and traditional authorities. So if you're a Zambian woman, your ability to use, control, manage land will be determined in large part by what are the rules of your chiefdom. And you may be able to get a kind of a customary certificate to land, but it'll be more difficult to get something that looks like a freehold title to your land. In fact, it's possible, but it's definitely more cumbersome. So yeah, there are some constraints on what you can do, and they can be pretty significant depending upon where you are in sub-Saharan Africa.
Absolutely. Before I dive into asking you a lot of questions about these details, I want to just set the stage for why is it important that women have ownership over land rights? Why is it important for women to have property rights? It seems maybe obvious to those of us in the West, but if we're trying to encourage access to land rights for women, why is it important? What's your go-to answer?
Yeah, I think my go-to answer is to ask people to consider why is it important for men to have, or for anyone in society to have, secure, clearly defined, implemented rights in property. So it's important for men so that they can make decisions about this particular piece of property that they are controlling. It enables, like, there's a whole bunch of economic reasons why you'd want to encourage people to have clear, secure rights over property. It gives them incentives to think about how to invest. It might give them incentives to think in a more long-term way about how to use the resource. It allows them to transfer the resource to people who can use it more efficiently, which is really good for everybody else when that's possible. It can, in some situations, allow them or give them an asset that they can leverage to access credit or financing, which they can then use for other purposes that are important for them and their families. I think for all those reasons, it's important for women, just like it is important for men. A couple of other things to say, of course, holding land is a form of power. If you hold a parcel of land, you have some degree of power within a community. Your power might only be, you know, I get to control this half of an acre or these 10 acres of land, but it's you still yours to control and make decisions about and use in an entrepreneurial way if you choose to use it that way. So one thing that I think is important for both men and women having property, having more secure property rights, is that it gives them a sense of dominion. This is mine. Other people outside of this area need to leave me alone in this place because I get to make the decision. So the autonomy, the agency that goes along with a property owner, I think is important for women and men. But to go back to women specifically, why is it important for women to have some degree or some secure ability to own and control land? There is a growing body of rigorous research that helps us understand what happens when women own land more secure, in a more secure fashion. And what tends to happen is women feel more secure. They experience less conflict. That could be conflict with family members, conflict with neighbors, because now there's more clarity about what is theirs, and there's presumably some way to back up their claims. Women, unlike men, this is important for if you're interested in, say, intergenerational issues. Women are, when they have more secure rights to land, have been shown to invest more in their children. They invest in children's education. They invest in their children's medical needs, well-being. So if we want families to be stronger and we want their children of families to have a really good start in life, we might want to be thinking about making sure that both members of the household have secure rights to land. Finally, it's important for women in those situations where family relations break down. It's unfortunately very common in sub-Saharan Africa, in certain parts, in certain areas, for women when their husbands take second wives, third wives, or just engage in out-of-marriage relationships, for women to be kicked off land that they've been using productively with their husbands. And they've been using to support their children. So what I might call family land grabbing is a not uncommon situation. And it's worse when women don't have a legal document that provides them with rights, some degree of rights over that land. So having recognized legal rights can also help women in situations where family relations break down. If they're just kicked off the land, they will have, you know, limited assets, limited ability to care for their kids. And that's important. There's also been some research that's been done that shows that women who have legally recognized rights over land and housing, both different kinds of real property, may experience lower levels of gender-based violence.
Oh, interesting. There seems to be quite a big difference between rules in form and potentially rules in use in sub-Saharan Africa. If a woman has a formal acknowledgement of a land right, does she always get to hold on to that claim in practice?
The answer is no, but the answer is also no for men. And so the reason for this, there could be at least two reasons, and I may think about a third or a fourth reason. So the first reason is formal rights need to be effective, need to be implemented. And if you were to look across much of sub-Saharan Africa, so here's one way in which the situation has improved since I started working on this issue 20 years ago. 20 years ago, legal frameworks were, you know, you might say weaker than they are today. So there have been a number of land laws passed, land policies enacted that do provide for more equitable ownership control over land and resources. But those laws need to be implemented to be effective. So I can have, as you're saying, a right like in form. I can have even a piece of paper, a document that says I'm an owner or a co-owner of this property, But if there aren't authorities around to enforce my rights, then, you know, it's sort of meaningless almost. That's the case, though, for women and men. You know, in a lot of places, the government is just kind of absent or doesn't have the capacity, the staffing, the personnel, the interest to actually go out and enforce land rights, particularly in really remote rural areas. That would be, you know, there's limited government presence in a lot of countries in those sorts of situations. But there's another problem, which it might be what you're getting at. So even if I have a formal right to land, it could be, depending upon where I'm sitting and what my culture is, that my family does not want to encourage me to exercise my rights. And that can be the case not only in sub-Saharan Africa, but in other parts of the world as well. So, as another example, it can be quite common in parts of India for girls to cede their rights to land to their brothers, because the family's perception is that the brothers are going to need to use the land for productive purposes. The brothers may have social obligations to care for parents in different ways from girls. And so the girl is going to get land through her husband. She doesn't need her own land. That notion that women, girls are going to get access to land from husbands or other families, that's a very common still perception and norm. And that can make it difficult for people who have rights in form to actually have rights in practice.
I imagine that sometimes the formal rules that are developed by a government are in conflict or clash with local customs or traditions as well. And that would, in addition, like you're saying, cause problems.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can look at a number of constitutions in Africa, and you'll see written in the constitution that the government supports and promotes and protects like gender equality, as an example. And you can read their land law, and the land law will have a principle related to equal access and ownership of land for women and men. But if someone is living in one of the areas in sub-Saharan Africa where really what matters, what has legitimacy, is customary norms and practices that are maintained by the local traditional authority, whether it's a chief or a clan leader or a religious leader, those are the rules that matter for those people. And so they may not even know about what the formal law says, because their day-to-day existence is really mediated by, informed by the customary rules that, kind of like the English common law, have evolved over a very long period of time and reflect the interests, the conditions of that community. So yeah, there can be like direct conflict around these issues.
So we have one set of problems revolving around the nationalization of land rights, but also rights to resources, where you could live in a country where the government has actual ownership and just grants rules of use. We have another issue where formal rules and laws that are on the books might not reflect or be in direct conflict with local traditions and customs. And then even if all of those things kind of work out, an individual, man or woman, might still encounter additional problems. Where do you start? This just seems like an issue that it's got a lot going on. I'm still trying to wrap my head around it. How do you, like, where are your points of intersection where you're like, I think that we should start here, or we could address these problems first? When you're, this just seems like such a big problem. How do you start?
Yeah, it is a big problem. That's part of what makes it really interesting to work on, that there's a lot going on. There's a lot of difference at the local level from place to place. At the same time, there's like some important similar points. Years ago, when I was at before I was at Mercatus, I was at the law school at George Mason. And I remember asking one of the older law professors, hey, like, what's your advice to people who are sort of just starting out in their career? And he said, oh, you should definitely work on the most complicated thing you can find. So I kind of feel fortunate. I found like a really complicated thing to work on that has kept me engaged and interested for two decades, and still lots of stuff to learn and lots of interesting issues to work on. So where to start? Yeah, it like this will depend upon a number. There are a number of ways to think about this question. Usually, you need to figure out first: Do you have anybody in government who wants to make a change? And that can be a pretty big ask for some governments, because you know, imagine like you are the government and like, you are technically the controller of all this stuff, which means the revenue and the rents, if they're being generated, are like sort of a lot of them supposed to go to you. So encouraging change from the government at the government level, that's really important to understand. Is there actually a window of opportunity to work with folks in government to make some changes? And you have to understand that those changes, even if they're made on paper, then need to be implemented. So you need to understand too, what are the norms within the bureaucracies? I think this is actually a super important question. What is it that people expect from the folks who are going to actually have to implement the laws and the regulations? Because norms are different in different bureaucracies, in different cultures. And the norms for many people in other parts of the world might be, first and foremost, you are not a like public servant, in air quotes. You are someone who's taking care of your family, and you are taking care of, you are one of the lucky few people who has a government job and a stable source of income, and you need to be in that position to generate income for what might be quite a large set of folks who depend upon you, because other people are not either working or they're working informally. And so the sort of impartial delivery of government services may not be something you can depend upon, depending on the local place. Where, you know, you could also start by trying to understand what's the level of corruption in the land system in a particular country. Transparency International has done some interesting work on corruption in the land sector, and it's, you know, usually like the fourth most corrupt sector in a country. So it's very hard to get documents for land. It takes a long time. It's bureaucratic. There are many steps in the process, which creates opportunities for corruption, for people to pay to get what they want. And that, you know, in some cases, I think that the important thing to understand is that might be welcomed because it gives people additional income to take care of their families. So you could work on the public sector side, but you could also, and you have to do this in many places, you have to understand what actually are those rules under the customary system that people pay attention to. And I think this is a very Hayekian point, actually. Why did those norms evolve in the ways they did in these places? And what is the information that those norms contain that I should be paying attention to if I want to do any work on a very sensitive issue? This is a highly sensitive political issue in virtually every place in the world. I mean, like, land is a sensitive issue here in the United States. If you were to Google foreign ownership of ag land, you would see probably hundreds of stories that have come out over the last 2 years. So it is sensitive here. It's very sensitive overseas.
If you were to try to understand the issue from a more bottom-up lens, understanding what's happening at the community level, how those norms evolved, how do you go about doing that, especially if you're not actually from the area where you're studying?
Yeah, this is a good challenge, and it's a really good question. So in part, and I think Mercatus has done an excellent job at this. In part, what you need to do is actually spend time in communities, and you need to do what people would almost consider to be like legal anthropology. You need to put on your detective hat or put on your detective mind and go in a very, like, in an extremely humble way and talk with people about what they think, like, how do you do things here? Can you help me explain how you do things here? Why do you do it that way? What are the benefits of doing it that way? What are some of the challenges that you have doing things this way? Are there ways that you understand or can think of that might make the situation better? What help would you need to make this, to make the situation better? So I think, yeah, a lot of humility. Some of that work can be done through desk research before you go to a place, but sometimes you just have to go to a place, sit with people, listen, understand what their concerns and challenges are.
In your experience attempting to do this, have you ever encountered situations where people are just not receptive to you coming in and asking questions about their community? And also, do you find that people just say what they think you want to hear?
Yeah, I think that's the latter point particularly, I think, is always a concern. And so it means that necessitates a little bit more work on your part. You almost need to be doing like snowballing interviews. So you're trying to hear from many different people. What do they think about this issue? Still the case, though, that right, I'm never going to be a local person in rural Tanzania. I can have worked there for many years and understand more than the average American about what's going on in Tanzania, but I'm never going to understand in the way that a local Tanzanian is going to understand that. Are there times when people don't want to talk to you? Yeah, and you should respect that. If people don't want to talk to you, then that's not a good place to probably be doing work. You can look for opportunities to do something that might be related that would eventually over time get you first build trust with the community and get you to a place where you could have a conversation again about other things. But I think as someone who's doing work in other cultures and other communities, yeah, you just have to really be willing to listen, to keep in a respectful way asking questions and doing your best to understand what is the problem this norm is solving for. And that just takes a little bit of time and effort.
Do you see more success when you're targeting more top-down government or public sector reforms versus when you're trying to target more bottom-up community-based reforms? Or I'm sure both have their own unique set of problems and issues, but is there a strategy where you say, well, we're going to mostly concentrate on the public sector because we have an in, there's someone that wants to change, and that's a really great way to see results? Or how do you balance the two sides to the coin?
I think it depends on where you are and what's going on in that country or sub-region of a country at the time that you're doing work. I'm going to just remind folks that in 1820, women were not allowed to own property in the United States. It took a series of state laws over the course of many decades in the United States to get us to the place where, kind of where you started, Jessica, which is, well, we take for granted that we can own land. And actually today, more women are homeowners than men in the United States. So it took a long time to get there. And those changes were driven by a combination of legal changes from the top and some shifting norms, right, over time. It's really interesting to think about both how long it took for women to get those rights and what the benefits of property ownership have translated into for the United States. And we can share stories like that in other countries. Well, you know, we went through a similar journey. We made these changes in the past, today, here's what our situation is like. You may or may not want to have that experience in your country, but, you know, we have gone through something that looks a little bit similar to what you're doing. So yes, if you have a policy champion, that can be a good place to start. That policy champion, though, needs to be supported by folks who can actually do implementation on the ground. So sometimes that is the bigger problem, not so much getting buy-in for a new law or new policy, but rather, okay, well, who's going to actually implement this policy once it's passed? And then at the local level, here I would say people want to be secure. And an interesting, you know, point, something interesting to point out is that if people are in a rural area far from cities, and there's no mineral wealth around, they may actually feel pretty secure without any formal documented right to their land because there's no pressure on the land. Maybe until populations start increasing or people move in, refugees move in, or, oh my gosh, we just discovered lithium is here. And then a lot of other people want the land. But I think people want to be secure. A customary system can provide security, especially when there's not a lot of pressure on land for other people to use it. Once that pressure starts in, though, it can be it can create a lot of insecurity for people who get whose property gets taken away by the state, given to a variety of actors. And so if people are feeling insecure, if you can work in an area where people do feel like they want some additional security, that can also be a good place to start doing work. And usually people understand we need security, not just today, we need security for the next generation. And women play a really important role when it comes to making the case that we want to protect our children as well. So one of the, probably the key reason why women will search out land and property rights is because they want their children to be secure. They will, on their own, they will say, we need to make this change in our community because I need to know that my children will be able to use this parcel of land.
That makes a lot of sense. For the policy champion, does it ever make a difference if the policy champion or if someone that comes into power is a woman versus a man? Are there any examples of that occurring and then we see change in a positive direction? Or once you're kind of in power, does the incentive to capitalize on that?
I think that's an interesting question. I'm not sure I have enough examples to really make a sort of, oh, it's like this always kind of response for you. There, of course, have been a number of African leaders who have been women in different countries. I think where most land reform has certainly happened under the direction of men. But one thing that I think is quite interesting is in some countries, you'll find traditional leaders that are women as well as men. Some of the strongest advocates for women's land rights have been traditional, like chieftainesses, who understand that the women in their communities, particularly women who lose husbands because they pass away or there's a divorce or it's a polygamous environment, they see what happens to these women when they're kicked off land. They become, you know, they might become literally destitute because the asset that they've been relying on has been taken away from them. And the other thing to say is culturally, they really can't go back to their natal families. Once you leave, it's hard to return. It can be quite hard to return to your parents' home. And if you have brothers, your brothers are already using the land at your parents' home. So chieftainesses and chiefs both, I think we have really interesting examples over time of traditional leaders, authorities, themselves becoming champions for stronger land rights for women because they see it benefiting the community more broadly, protecting the future of the children, and contributing to usually improved use or different uses of the land assets in the area. So I think it depends. I don't have like one political leader, like I can't say Ellen Johnson Sirleaf in Ghana made a critical contribution to the Ghanaian land law. She might have with regard to gender equality. I think it happens under a lot of different regimes.
That makes sense. It's interesting to think about the role that the chief or the chiefdoms play in the system. They are they considered like formal members of government, or are they more on the informal side? How would you think about them?
Again, it depends on what country you're in. So in some countries, there are formal structures for chiefs and leaders that are incorporated into the formal governance structure. In Zambia, for example, there's a House of Chiefs, and the chiefs all come together, and they may be contributing to the way that, or they're certainly commenting on the way policies are developed and followed in the country. In other countries, it would be quite different. In some countries, there's not a strong presence of traditional leaders, but there will be other people who might be religious leaders who play an incredibly important role in identifying norms, behaviors, practices. So in some places, traditional leaders might be a counterbalance to the formal government, right? They might almost be in competition in some ways. In other places, they would have maybe a less prominent role, but still an important social role.
Got it. Interesting. Again, lots of variation.
See why it's so interesting to work on?
Yes. No, there's endless questions that you could pull from this. When you are doing your research, given the high level of variation that exists just within sub-Saharan Africa, are there specific countries that you have concentrated on? Like how has that worked?
Oh yeah, there's a really practical answer to this question. And that is that my French is not great. It's okay. So I've tended over time for ease of language to work in Anglophone countries. But I have worked in some Francophone countries, and I've done a bit of work in Lusophone countries like Mozambique particularly. So I have no Portuguese. I have minimal French. And so that is actually, you know, in the past, that's been a real constraint. It's getting easier and easier, though, given technology, to work in places where language, there's this, you know, a big language difference. And of course, I just want to say, I don't speak any local languages. So another challenge, you know, getting back to an earlier question you raised about, are people just telling you what you want to hear? Maybe yes. In addition, if you're relying on a translator, you need to have a lot of confidence in your translator that you're actually getting what people are saying, and you're getting it with the nuance that they are providing you. So interpretation's another whole issue.
That absolutely makes sense. Again, there's just a lot. There's a lot of things going on. I liked your example earlier of how in the mid-1800s, women in the United States couldn't hold land, and that slowly changed over time as both culture and informal norms changed and policy changed from the top down. We forget that because we're just sort of assuming like, oh yeah, we know this is right and good or correct. This is how it should be. And then how do you balance this sort of like innate want to look out at the world and say, this is a problem, this should be fixed, versus acknowledging how long and complicated and many twists and turns solving that problem will take? I imagine it's frustrating to want to hold out a magic wand and say, now everyone has land rights in this country and that will improve things, when the reality is we can never actually do that in a way that's effective. Do you ever get maybe disillusioned or like considered career changes because you're like, this is just never going to happen. It's so complicated. It's going to continue after my lifetime. Does this ever happen, or you're just like any marginal change, you're like, yes, we're moving in the right direction. This makes it worth it.
So that's also a big question for me. And I think I can look back over the past 20 years and I definitely see change, and I see change that's positive in a lot of places. One of the best places, or one of the really interesting engines of change, is urbanization. So as countries urbanize, urban land becomes very valuable. there is a lot of pressure in urban areas to develop clearer land markets so that people can capture the value, the increasing value of urban lands. It's usually easier for, it can be easier for women in urban spaces than to participate in land markets, to acquire housing, to acquire a parcel, and use those assets in ways that men do. So build a business, have more secure housing for themselves and their families. And then those women who are in urban spaces may have family members in rural areas, and there's communication urban to rural, and people can see what the benefits of land markets might be. Some people are never going to want to be selling land, right? We should understand that. There are some communities that do not want to participate in land markets. Land is a cultural, spiritual asset for them. And that's their choice, right? That's their choice. Hopefully, people respect their choices. But a lot of people do want to use their land in a way that allows increased productivity or increased value addition. And when that starts happening, then I think you do see a fair amount of change. It is a challenging issue to work on in a lot of cases. And again, back to that PowerPoint from earlier, because people who hold land have power. And usually people who have power don't want to give up their power. And so shifting, for example, from a situation where all land vests in the name or in the office of the president to a system of all freehold property, yeah, poof. Like you, that's probably not what you'd want to be starting with. You'd want to be starting with helping to secure longer term use rights for people on the ground.
What are some other examples of successes that you've seen over the years or that kind of motivate you to keep diving into this research?
Oh, I definitely think with regard, particularly with regard to women, there has been a lot of attention to the issue of why it matters for women to have secure land rights over the last 20 years. And there is a big body, there is a growing body of rigorous evidence about what the outcomes or impacts of those changes can be at the household level. And it's compelling, right? There's a lot of good evidence that suggests that communities, families, eventually it'll be economies more broadly, benefit from extending these secure rights to other members of society. So not just providing them to men. And we'll see over time, presumably, that benefits extend to children because children have been better educated by mothers who have land rights. Children are healthier. There will be intergenerational benefits that arise from that. So, yeah, I think there's reason to think that the combination of good research and there's always a desire on the part of governments to want investment. So a combination of evidence that securing these rights can lead to important investments at the household level, but securing the rights also is going to help improve your enabling environment and make it more likely that certain investors will come to your country. That combination, in some places only, gives me hope that we'll continue to see change.
Amazing. On the other end, there are some countries where women themselves are viewed as property. How do you go into a culture or society that holds this belief and try to change the mindset that instead of women themselves being property, instead women should be able to hold property? I know, again, this is like a very huge question, very big question, but when you're encountering like a culture or a society or a group of people that have strong beliefs about something like this, what do you do?
I can say that I've seen less of this kind of comment over the last 20 years. So I definitely have had people tell me that.
It's decreasing.
And it's like I hear it less. And it could just be that I'm not working in the places where that kind of an attitude would be extremely prevalent. But it could also be that actually over the last 20 years, norms have begun to shift a bit. You know, in most of the countries where, in many countries in sub-Saharan Africa, there are women's organizations themselves that are asking for change. Depending upon the environment, if it's highly authoritarian, you might not hear so much from them, but pretty much every country has a network of women's organizations, lawyers' associations, civil society organizations that are making the case. You know what? We all together will be stronger, better off, better able to participate, whether it's in global markets or local markets, if we have the ability to leverage and use these assets in creative ways that we can think about, if we're not keeping half of the population out of the, you know, effectively out of the economy. But when it comes to such a deeply held norm like the one you're talking about, yeah, I think it does take a lot of time and a lot of conversation, and you may not see change in the short term. And maybe this would be a little bit like, this is not a perfect analogy, but it might be a little bit like how abolitionists felt in the 19th century, right? It takes a lot of time. It took a lot of work for people to stop seeing people as property. All people are Black people as property. And so, you know, a lot of people work on this issue. And that actually, I think, is also, people work on this issue at all levels, from the highest global level down to a community in rural Tanzania. There's work going on at every one of those levels in many places. So that's also encouraging.
Absolutely. One of our colleagues here at the Mercatus Center, Christine McDaniel, just came out with a research piece on the benefits of globalization for women specifically. And I imagine that this could be another positive of having a more interconnected economy. Isolated places that get incorporated into the world economy and interact more and more with other cultures and customs and people that are very different from them could start to change people's minds or introduce them to new ways of living.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, we get introduced to the way other people live, and that's a benefit for us. And other people in different parts of the world see, you know, things are different in other places. It's the way we live our lives is not necessarily the way other people live their lives. I would say one of the interesting, this would harken back to the Enterprise Africa work. Another way that this can be beneficial is through trading. There can be a benefit to, there can be like a an interest on the part of consumers in the Western world to support women entrepreneurs in other parts of the world. So coffee, specialty coffee, is a really good example of this. There are a lot of American specialty coffee importer companies that really like the idea of engaging with women farmers, coffee farmers in other parts of the world, and either working with them, usually through collectives or cooperatives, but working with women-driven cooperatives. And when women-driven cooperatives start to succeed, I think people then see, wow, you know, women are capable. They can be successful farmers. They can be entrepreneurs. They can manage assets effectively and efficiently. And so why wouldn't we allow them to do more?
What, in your opinion, is the role for education and awareness raising?
I do think that there's a really important role. Literacy rates have been rising in sub-Saharan Africa for the last two decades. This is one of the positive changes. People are more connected, whether that's through cell phones or through their hearing radio. They're getting information. People should understand what their formal legal rights are. Those legal rights might not, as we discussed, they might not align necessarily with cultural or customary rights. But it's important for people to understand, just to have the background. What are my rights? Like a know what you are supposed to be able to do in this place under these conditions. But a lot of people still aren't aware of those formal legal rights. And so part of what can happen and can be useful is just to expose men and women to the information about what the legal framework looks like in their country. I think it's really important it's important through all this work to engage consistently in a very respectful way with men and with boys. So, and help them understand what, you know, their leaders in their capital have said is the law, in addition to what their traditional authority might say. Some of that education can happen in schools, actually. Like, you can have, a country could have almost like a little mini curriculum on land issues or natural resource issues and why it's important for everyone in the community to have secure rights over assets. That can be an effective way to think about generating some good conversations. Kids then usually take that information back to their households and they can talk with their parents about what they're hearing. And parents might say, oh, that's ridiculous, that's not true. Or it can spark a conversation that generates or leads to some change. So I think having people aware of the variety, aware of first their national legal framework, and maybe regional frameworks are also quite important. So if Tanzania knows, oh, well, you know, Zambia does it this way, or Malawi does it this way, that can also be helpful. But in addition, through social media and through other newer ways of communicating and educating people, I think young people also really have an understanding that it's hard for them, young women and young men, to access land. And it would be helpful for many of them if it were it easier to access, to securely access land in their countries.
You mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, I think, that Rwanda now has close to 20% of women owning land. Was that correct?
So across sub-Saharan Africa, the figure for a number of women who have formally documented rights to land is probably like around 20%. It's hard to figure out because countries don't have dependable land information systems. Rwanda went through a very unique process a number of years ago of mapping and certifying every parcel of land in the country. I think it's 9 million parcels, maybe about 9 million parcels, and has maybe not delivered every piece of paper to every person, but they have spent a good amount of effort to make sure that their property system is clearer. I'm going to pause and say, like, I'm going to introduce another complexity for you, Jessica. So even though Rwanda has done this, and they've done it in a like with gender equality in mind, so you can, women and men were supposed to both have their, if they were married, have their names on these certificate, land certificates. That's great. That system's super helpful. It lowers search and information costs for people who want to figure out, like, how can I make use of property? It allows people to lease in, lease out property. Parcel sizes are very small in Rwanda, high population, not a lot of land. And a lot of the land is hilly, so only so much fertile, good land to use. But all that good work that Rwanda did will not matter if people do not register subsequent transactions. So if I'm a landholder and I die, my children need to go back to the registry office and let the government know they are now the owners of the property. So property systems are only as accurate as people make them. So Rwanda is like this incredible example of a government buying in, doing the process. If you look up today, if anyone online, anyone listening wants to do this, look up IREMBO, IREMBO. Rwanda has a whole online service for things like birth certificates, land registration, subsequent transactions in land, whether it's a sale or leasing. They're way ahead of the game in sub-Saharan Africa around how they deal with their land information. So it would be higher than that in Rwanda, higher than 20% in Rwanda. Took a lot of time, took a lot of money. They did it. But they need to keep, like, they need to encourage people to keep doing it. But one of the amazing things, oh, this is super exciting. I would never have thought, if you hadn't asked about Rwanda, I wouldn't have thought about this. What's one of the real benefits of this? Rwanda is generating property tax revenue, and particularly in urban areas, and using that tax revenue to provide services to people, water services or electricity services or whatever, the education services. So this is like a missing piece of the development puzzle in much of sub-Saharan Africa. There is not a clear land information system. There is not clear land valuation. There are not property, you know, there are de minimis property taxation. And so public services that we also depend on at the municipal level, like the road is paved or the streetlights work, that stuff doesn't get done because that revenue isn't there.
That is so fascinating how connected everything is, and parts that you didn't think like would be connected, recording the land rights for people and having a place where all of that is managed then allows for people to own land and then allows the government to collect property taxes, which then allows them to deliver all of these services. That's actually a really, really interesting example of how complex this issue is and how almost everything is connected, because the world is messy and complicated and connected probably on a deeper level than we even realize.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, like I said earlier, I've been working on this issue for 20 years and I am always learning something I wasn't aware of and seeing a connection maybe I hadn't seen in quite the same way previously. So it's a great issue to work on. And I'm delighted that you were interested in hearing me talk about it.
Of course. If someone wanted to dive more into this topic, given that we've mostly just talked about how complicated it is, and if someone's like, you know, that one part was really interesting, I'd love to dive deeper into it. Where should they go? Who should they read? Are there specific sources that you would recommend to someone who wants to do research on this topic?
I think if you're a researcher, so if you're sort of generally interested in land and property, if you're listening to this podcast, you might already be familiar with people like Richard Pipes, who's written on property and freedom. That's a great book, highly recommended. Tom Bethel's book on property, which is older now, also a really good book. If you're researching, though, like there's a lot of development economics that's come out over the last, especially last 15 years on land issues. And so you'd find that in Land Use Policy, the journal Land Use Policy, World Development, some of those kinds of journals. But like a quick go-to source, if you're new to this issue, there is an organization called the Land Portal Foundation. It's Land Portal Foundation, because there's another land portal that does other stuff. The Land Portal Foundation is like a one-stop shop for all things, all things land. They have events, they host webinars, they have research, people send them materials. So they have country profiles. So you can learn a lot by sort of digging around on Land Portal. Some of the researchers whose work I really like, and I'm going to focus on two women now, particularly down at the University of Richmond. So we're sitting in Arlington, Virginia, but down at the University of Richmond, Sandra Jowerman does really super interesting work on land, property, conflict. I think she's terrific. An older book that I like a lot is Catherine Boone's book on property and political power. That's a good one. So there's a lot of resources, and, you know, I would say, you know, more every day, actually. If you're looking for impact evaluation results, there are today about, I don't know, well over two dozen rigorous impact evaluations of land interventions. And so, but there need to be more. So this is actually a great area for people who are interested in that kind of rigorous evaluation work. To get involved in, because the more we know from those kinds of evaluations, the more we can help people, governments, other folks improve the way the work is done.
To finish up the podcast, I just want to ask you, how did you get involved in this work? What inspired you to choose this as your research topic. And if someone wanted to follow in your footsteps, someone wanted to do this work and dedicate decades of their life to it, what would you recommend? What would you say to them?
So I would say, don't do what I did, is the first thing. So I did study international law at law school. I assumed when I was at law school, I would end up in public international law, which is like UN stuff. And that is not what I ended up doing for a whole variety of reasons. I got interested in the land stuff first through working with economists like Bruce Yandel and particularly Bruce. It was just a really big influence on my thinking. Bruce was working on questions along with Terry Anderson of how was the American West, what were sort of property relations like in the American West, and then how did the common law help us address environmental issues? So those questions were like my early entry into thinking about land issues. And I know this is going to sound like insane, but one day, I think it was in 2003, I was reading the newspaper and there was a story about a massacre in Nigeria. A bunch of herders had killed a bunch of farmers. And I thought it was horrible, and it's horrible. And it's still going on today. Those problems exist all across the Sahel in Africa, farmer herder conflict. And because I had read Terry Anderson and Roger Miner's and Bruce Yandel's work coming out of PERC, I thought that's really, and like I had been to law school, so we knew about COSI and bargaining. I thought that's really interesting. Why are they killing each other? And why is there not a better way to solve this problem? It sounds really silly. That article is the whole kernel of my work overseas. It was that one article and that question, why is it this way, that really intrigued me and got me started looking at the problem. And it seemed like part of the problem was this disconnect between customary systems and formal systems, inability to do dispute resolution in an effective way, but also ignoring the old customary systems. So anyway, that's a long and complicated answer. I would say if people are interested in doing this work, legal anthropology is actually a good background. But for anyone who's going to be engaging in like more rigorous, and I don't mean this like the legal anthropologists aren't rigorous, so that's not what I mean. But for a lot of people, having some economics background is going to be really, really helpful, particularly being able to understand a little bit of what's going on when you see an impact evaluation and being able to contribute to that. So there are a lot of ways into this work. You can come at it from many different angles. It is really interesting work, but there's like a lot of interesting, and there are lots of interesting questions that are left that we haven't quite solved yet. So there are still research gaps in this sector.
What would, in your opinion, be the research questions if you were a young professional just starting out that you would choose to try to answer? What are the big holes that you see as still needing to be filled?
A question I think about on a fairly regular basis is, what is the value of reduced levels of conflict in a community? So if a community does receive a land, does like systematically have their land titled or registered, we see over and over again that levels of conflict go down. When levels of conflict go down, people should have more time, more resources to do other productive things. But that's a guess. We don't really have much in the way of like local level evidence about what do those benefits actually look like when people have additional time and they're not spending money on lawyers or going to court. What do they do with the money? What difference does it make for the community? So that's a question that's kind of pressing. I think for women's land rights, there's a great article that Ruth Mines and Dick from the University from WashU in St. Louis published with some co-authors, probably also with Agnes Quisumbing in 2019. That is a review of what are the benefits, or what does literature say about women's land rights specifically? And there are definitely some gaps. So there are, you know, we could use a lot more information about the steps between giving women, certifying women's land rights and outcomes like food security. So we may know that women have greater decision-making authority within households. We may know that women are more likely to choose particular kinds of crops to grow when they get their title, but kind of like the steps in the process up to, and is their household more food secure over time? That it would be good to know a little bit more about that as well.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. This is a really complicated and very fascinating topic that I learned a lot just in this conversation with you. Is there any final thoughts or concluding remarks that you would like to have?
Oh, thank you, Jessica. It's a pleasure to talk with you. It's always good to be back at Mercatus and sharing thoughts. I would say a lot of this work really is the result of the time I spent at Mercatus. I might do a final shout out, if I may, to Paul Dragos Alagica, who was another incredible mentor for me and really helped me think about a whole set of opportunities related to these kinds of institutional economics questions that I might not have explored otherwise. So it's great to be able to talk with folks at Mercatus and just recognize how important the institution was in my career.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time today. It was really lovely hearing from you.
Thank you so much, Jessica.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.